Season 2, episode number 29, the Sarah Spain interview. I had fallen prey the way I had not imagined. The Keep It 100 Girl podcast is brought to you by Breather Workspaces. Breather has great views and all the amenities you need to get focused and productive. If you're an entrepreneur looking for a beautiful, practical space, you can reserve a Breather Workspace on the go. So if you need a final location, or if you're traveling to a metropolitan city like New York, LA, San Fran, DC, Toronto, Montreal, London, Palo Alto, Boston, or Chicago, and look, you need a workspace for a few hours, try it using my promo code QFKJZA. Again, QFKJZA. And this will give you a great discount with at least 80% off the first hour. Visit breather.com to check out all their international workspaces. Welcome to the Keep It 100 Girl podcast. This is my jam. I love doing this show. I discover every week 50 shades of cray cray and reveal what people are thinking but not saying out loud. My episodes are directed to the uninformed girl and guy. And this is where I have positive influences on my listeners' lives who want to keep it 100. That's right. Keep it 100 means keeping the conversation real and true with no filters. I want to be that positive influence in your life. Nina helps people who want to learn how to do it with confidence. And you know what? We're going to celebrate embarrassment at the same time. Every week, men and women share their 50 shades of cray cray. In today's episode, Nina talks with esteemed sports media journalist Sarah Spain. And you know what? I've convinced her, and it wasn't that hard, to celebrate her embarrassment. So she's going to share her personal wake-up call for women in the industry. And also, I got some few girly things that you didn't know about her in this episode. Sarah's going to highlight situations where herself, as well as women in the sports media industry, or any industry for that matter, face sexual harassment. It's an unfair double standard that men in the industry really don't have to face. The goal in this episode is to make this industry better by being open and vocal about the issues that we still have and the things that women still face so that, you know what, when they're coming up and they have their come up, they don't feel alone and they're going to transition to that more established woman in their best life. To start the discussion, Sarah talks about her Beauty and the Beast tips. I asked Sarah to tell us something that we don't know about her. Like, what are her favorite skincare tips?
Oh my gosh, skincare tips. Okay, I'm on TV now, which means I can't ignore all the things that I used to sort of ignore when I was an athlete. And I knew that you were supposed to take care of your skin, but I sort of just would get lazy and put on like Clearasil. And then put on some sort of Clinique. But now I've sort of advanced a little bit. There is this, and the problem is I often forget the names of the product I'm using. I'll just like buy them. But one of my favorites is by, I think it's by Too Faced, and it's called Hangover RX. Whoa. And it's supposed to be for days after you've been out partying or maybe you're dehydrated from flying. And it's supposed to give you good moisture in the morning. And the reason I love it so much is because it has a hint of coconut. So it always feels like I'm on vacation or like I'm giving my skin a little trip to the beach, even if I'm just, you know, middle of winter and dehydrated. So that's one of my favorites. And gosh, what else do I love? I just actually tried a new mask and I'm going to forget the name. I want to say it's by like Drew Barrymore or something. In fact, hold on. It's right next to me. Huh. And you put it on with like almost like a paintbrush or like a thicker brush and it tightens your face. It's called, hold on. I have the, my makeup artist actually recommended it to me and I fell in love. And it basically, as it gets on your face, this combination of the gel and the fluid that you mix up in this little container, it tightens your skin and then opens up your pores so that you can let in the good stuff and let out the bad stuff. And it is called Hanacure, HANACure.com. And it's pretty magical. It's like almost like a photo light facial, but you do it at home.
And you feel the tightening happening? Is that?
Yes. You like during the half an hour that it's on, you can't really interact with other people because you try to talk to them and your face is frozen. But when you get it off, it just feels super tight. And even my makeup artist was like, you know, when I put your makeup on for the show today, it just comes on like butter because your skin is accepting it because you don't have this layer on top that you had to, you know, get off.
Secondly, this episode, as well as all of my other episodes, are directed to the uninformed woman. So it's just convenient for me to ask Sarah, what would women need to know in their 20s and 30s now that you've been there and you're doing it in your 30s?
Oh my gosh, a million things. Well, one thing that I always joke about was when I was in my early 20s living in LA, I remember I read, I think it was Jennifer Aniston in a magazine, saying something about her 30s being so much better than her 20s because she just didn't care anymore what people thought. And she was able to be her true self, surround herself with people that she loved and that were like her, and didn't feel like she was either competing or in bad cliques or surrounded by cattiness or pettiness or worried about what she needed to prove. She said her 30s were so much happier because of that. And I thought at the time, when I was an idiot 22 or 23 year old, that she was just trying to make herself feel better about getting old, right? I thought it couldn't possibly be better than your 20s. Your 20s is the best. And man, was she right. 30s is so much better. And you just are so aware of who you are and you accept your flaws better and you surround yourself with people that you love and you're too busy to waste time with people that you don't love. And it's just so freeing to be in your own body when you just are cool with all of your own idiosyncrasies and quirks and you love the people around you for their own uniqueness instead of feeling like there's any sort of group that you need to appease or any sort of cliques that you need to fit into. So I think in your 20s, you need to accept that you're still kind of figuring out who you are and that's okay, but lead with kindness for yourself and others because you'll find out later that some of that pettiness or rudeness that you might have exhibited towards others was stemming from your own insecurities. When you get older and you're happy with who you are, you're much more accepting of everybody else too, and kinder to them and more understanding about what they're going through or what makes them different or unique or maybe not your favorite sometimes. And then when you're in your 30s, just living it up and embracing all that. If you haven't gotten to that by the time you get to your 30s, then maybe try to figure out what's keeping you from settling in and being happy.
So Sarah, you ready to keep it 100?
Let's do it.
Let's keep it 100.
Keep it 100.
I always like to think that everybody's a product of their environment. What you see is what you get. And so tell us about Sarah, the athlete, the girl, the student, the on the career path planning from her 20s to present.
That's interesting. I do think people are a product of their environment, although it's interesting to see how different people can come up from the same place or similar backgrounds and be so so unique and find different paths. My 20s, I had just finished college at Cornell University. I was an English major and I was a heptathlete there. And I moved out to Chicago for 7 months to save up money and had a plan to get to LA. I was hoping to be a comedian and TV actress. My dream was to be on Saturday Night Live. And so I moved out to LA and I was out there for 6 years, started out doing the acting stuff, eventually found my way into a TV hosting class that required us to host fake shows to practice intros and teases and throwing to break. And I hosted a fake Chicago Bears class and my teacher said, oh, you want to work in sports? And I was like, there's no real women in sports. There's just, you know, bubbly sidelines reporters or very serious anchor people that don't seem to get to have a lot of fun. And I want to do comedy. So I don't think sports is the right spot for me. And she said, well, maybe just think about it. It seems very natural for you. So I was like, okay, I'll take an extension course at UCLA in TV sports reporting, just see what it's like. And I got there and I was like, I should have been doing this all along, you know? And I took all of my stuff from Second City Conservatory. I did the whole improv conservatory there. And then all of my sports background, and started working at Fox Sports Net as a PA and then an AP behind the scenes, writing for some blogs for free, trying to audition for some various web stuff. And I really tried to combine the entertainment and the comedy side with my sports knowledge and approach it in a way that I didn't see other women doing it, and really tried to presume that there was a space for women that just hadn't been filled yet, even though it wasn't out there. And it was really scary. Anytime you're out in LA, and particularly in a job like that where you don't have a set path to follow, especially when you're sort of type A, butt kissing Ivy Leaguer, where you think everything should just, you should just have an assignment and then do it really well and then get to the next thing. There was no assignment, there was no teacher, there was no syllabus. It was just me trying to figure out how to get to where I wanted to go. But it was fun. I mean, your 20s are fun. You get to make some mistakes, you get to have adventures, and then you have way more free time than you ever realize. It feels like you're busier than ever. And then you get to your 30s, you're like, oh, this is what busy really feels like.
Right. Exactly.
In this next clip, I asked Sarah Spain, prior to the start of your career, what did you hear about the industry? That's sports media industry, the journalistic industry in sports, women sportscasters. Remember, this is going to help frame our minds mentally. And keep in mind, Sarah's in her 20s. She had no exposure to all this online air stuff.
Yeah, it was tough. To be honest, it was sort of trial and error. I looked around at what was around me and the things that I enjoyed reading and watching and why, and I tried to figure out how to model what I wanted to do. Some of that was taking stuff that I saw from my improv classes or from other people's hosting reels or classes I took. But a lot of it was really just looking at the landscape around me and trying to figure out what was wanted and where I fit in. And unfortunately, especially back then, it was sort of the wild, wild west of sports blogging. This was maybe 2004, 2005. And the women that I saw that were on these websites, especially in these sort of lesser roles, the kind of entry level stuff that I thought I could do, there was always tons of cleavage, tons of makeup, and it was very much about being sort of this little teaser in the corner. Here's all your sports news, and then here's this girl in the corner with this sexy outfit that's going to tell you about your fantasy sports team or what the latest news is. And I sort of thought that was the only way to go about it, other than the most respected women that were doing HBO television shows, investigative journalism, or sports center anchors. That middle ground, I just didn't see very many women in the spaces, especially writing. There's a bunch of really funny sports blogs that were very clearly geared towards men. And so you had to read them and sort of realize that you weren't really welcome there. You weren't invited to the party, but if you wanted to get in on the sports stuff and you wanted to be a part of this very funny counterculture web environment, you had to sort of suck it up and accept the digs at women or the accompanying bikini photos that had nothing to do with the content. And eventually that's sort of how I got started, was trying to buy into that. And it wasn't until later that I realized that I had sort of felt like that was the only way to get into the business. And now I try my best to write about and talk to up and coming girls about finding ways to make that break and get into the business without having to feel like you are being something you're not. Because I've always been funny and wanted to be funny and not really been comfortable trying to be sexy. And that felt like it was a requirement of the up and coming women in the industry. It has gotten a lot better though, which is huge for especially former jocks and comedians and any women who don't feel like that's their natural state, is trying to, you know, flirt their way into a job.
Did you ever anticipate like what it would be like working in a predominantly male environment, especially with just like how you alluded to, like these women that were just kind of the Vanna White in the corner?
To anyone starting their career in a male-dominated space, in this next segment, Sarah and I talk about the inevitable nature of how every woman is bound to come across a guy who's going to make you feel awkward, whether he's inappropriate with touching you, or lastly, maybe he's just straight up hits on you. Unfortunately, it only takes once to reach that anticipate mindset. And what I mean by that is, it only takes once where you're now officially in the club, where you're trained to see, to anticipate these moves. I don't even know what adjective to use here, but these man moves from a mile away going forward. But no matter what, the end result is always going to come to feeling awkward.
To this guy's home and anticipating that you'd get a taxi in 20, 30 minutes. And he's obviously coercing you, you know, inch by.
Yeah, so that came later. Like, I think it's worth noting that unfortunately, sexual harassment happens in every industry, even the ones that are not male dominated. It can happen at any job where there's a power structure that allows somebody with ill intent to take advantage, but it certainly seems and feels to be more predominant in industries where there are so few women. And I think when I got into it, I was pretty naive. You know, my parents have a law practice together. I've always been competing against the guys in sports. I've always had a lot of guy friends. I've always, you know, considered myself somebody who couldn't be told that I couldn't do something. And I think when you're younger, that feels very easy because you haven't yet seen the challenges and the barriers you're going to face. I had this wonderful television writer, Nell Scovell, on my podcast, and she's written for The Simpsons, and she created Sabrina Teenage Witch and wrote for David Letterman, and she's so successful. And she said the same thing. She said she was coming out of Harvard believing that she was sort of, the world was her oyster and she could do anything. And it wasn't until she got into those TV rooms and realized that she wasn't being treated the same, and that it was not because of her abilities or because of her intelligence or what she could offer, but rather the preconceived notions about her or the boys club that wouldn't allow her to break in. And that's the same for me. I think when I realized that there was a dearth of women in the industry, but to me it was just a matter of, oh, well, I'm just gonna work harder and be better, and I'm gonna find my way. And throughout my career, even now, you know, in my 30s and more established voice, I still come across the issues that are inherent for women, whether that comes from people within your own industry or even the fans and social media users that don't believe that there's a role for women. So I think I was pretty naive when I started. I fairly quickly became aware of the many kind of roadblocks that people will try to set up. And it wasn't until that first big audition that you mentioned where I felt the true understanding of what it is to be in a position of no power, where you're a nobody trying to get your first big gig at a bigger name, and somebody who's established there tries to take advantage of that. And I don't know if you want me to tell that story now or save it for later, but that was a big wake up.
Yeah, let's talk about the wake up call and now how you transitioned into a woman with more of an established.
Right. So basically I was working at Fox Sportsnet in LA as a PA and at AP, and I was writing for a couple sports blogs, and I had caught the eye of a bigger company, and they were flying me out. I was supposed to meet with the guy, but he had been out of town for something and was just flying back or getting back in. So they said, why don't you guys grab dinner, because you're going to need to eat anyway, and chat, and we're going to have you guys on camera together tomorrow. So we just want to kind of have a feel for what your relationship would be like if we were going to use you guys on camera. So we went. And he said, oh, there's a going away party nearby for one of my colleagues if you want to go there. And just started drinking and, you know, introduced me to one of the other people that he worked with, and then said, what color eyes does she have? I haven't made it up there yet. And I was like, oh, that's an odd thing to say about someone that you potentially would work with. And then continued drinking, took me to another event, and then said we were nearby where he lived and would I want to see where I might live if I moved there to work there. And then the World Series was on. Oh, well, so this game's almost over. Let's finish watching and then okay, so I'm watching, and then he tried to kiss me. I told him no. I said, you know, that you're, I really want this job. You're making it very difficult for me because you're being, like, you know, inappropriate. It's making me uncomfortable, and, you know, this can't happen. And then I said, I'm going to take a cab. And he said, oh, okay, I'll come help you call one. He told me that it'd be maybe a half hour to get a cab there, which I have since found out is not the case. It would have come very soon. And then when it didn't come, he said, I'll just have to drive you. It's probably not going to come, even though he probably never even called it. And then on the way home, I was already nervous to be driving with him because he'd been drinking. But he started talking about how great our sex life would be and asking whether I manicure certain areas of my body and just completely inappropriate things. And finally dropped me off. The next day I went in and he stood over the back of my chair as I was sitting and said to another colleague, boss of his, I have an idea for a show. It's just a half hour of me standing over Sarah and staring at her tits. And again, I was like, I'm in an office right now with another employee who just laughed at that. Where am I? Like, what is this? This is not how a job is supposed to go, a job interview. And that guy who he had said that to later said, you were so fantastic. You know, even if you came in tomorrow and took a shit on my desk, you'd still get the job. And I was like, what? Everything about this was so unprofessional. And so, of course, I didn't get the job. I have no idea whether they didn't really think I was great, but after telling me how great I am and then not getting the job, I had to assume part of it was that I had rejected this guy and his advances. And I didn't say anything. And I continued to see him. And I still sometimes do because he still works in the industry. And I don't know what I would tell women when this happens to them, because you want to say that you have to go tell someone and not let this continue, but you have zero power. You don't even work for that company. Do you approach HR for a company you don't even work for? Do you tell other people about this person? Do you risk being considered a troublemaker, even though you had nothing to do with it? Because of the way we now still see these incidents, so often it's the woman who is blamed for it, even if she had no power over the situation and was not the reason for it happening. And so I think what I've learned since is to not be naive about this and to understand what positions lines maybe I have to draw and set before, whether that's, oh, you know, I'd rather not go to the going away party. I'd rather talk one-on-one or maybe go to a coffee shop or grab food at the cafeteria here or do whatever. But I think, unfortunately, you can tell women great advice and they can make the best choices. And if somebody is manipulative and sets out to create a bad situation, they're going to continue to try to do that. And at my age now, I certainly, with the agency I have and the voice I have, would report that person. But I don't know exactly what the best advice is for an up and coming person who's trying to make it in those situations, because too often, if you are in a company or a place where the person in charge doesn't get it, you may be punished for that, whether you did something or not, which is unfortunate. But thankfully, I am now in a position where I don't know that it would happen to me as much, because so often these men prey on the powerless and the up and coming. But if it did, I would have absolutely no qualms about going to my superiors and their superiors and whoever else needed to be involved.
Was this your first interview out of college?
No, I was a couple years out of college by then, but it was my first big interview for an on-air TV job, and the first time I had flown anywhere to go interview for a job.
So, talk about this 20-year-old girl who has been disrespected in a professional way. How do you regroup? I mean, just take yourself back to that moment. How do you regroup and eventually just move on? What were this? Was it like confiding in somebody? Was it getting therapy? Was it talking to your parents or have a law practice? Like, how do you just, I guess, reconcile what happened and move on?
Yeah, I think I was dating a guy at the time. And so when I got back to my hotel that night, after that first night, I did call him and complain about how BS it was and also how disappointed I was that some of the rumors I had heard about the industry were true. That, you know, some of these things that I thought maybe were antiquated and had gotten better had not. And that I had fallen prey to it in a way that I had not imagined I would. You know, I'm 6 feet tall. I'm this badass athlete. I've always been super outspoken. And there was a toughness about me that I think I naively thought that I wouldn't be subject to something like that. And it does. It makes you feel shame for some reason, even if you had absolutely nothing to do with it. You start to wonder what you did wrong or how you can blame yourself for it. And that's the way society victim blames. We've kind of been conditioned to do that and not to understand that if somebody has ill intent, if they're manipulative, and if they try to abuse their power and use that to control, it doesn't have to do with something that you said or did. It's them. And I remember calling that guy I was dating. I remember when I got home from the trip, talking to my parents about how disappointed I was. And there was a part of me that thought, okay, well, I'm never going to work there. Or maybe I'm not going to make it because this is what it requires. I don't have what it takes if I can't deal with that. But it was very brief. I think I've always been someone that when I'm challenged, it just makes me want it more and makes me defiant about not being stopped. And so I had a brief, you know, week or so of being super depressed about it, especially when I didn't get the job. And then I went right back to work. Okay, I'm going to work somewhere else where this isn't going to happen, which of course was naive because it happens everywhere. But I really thought that I would be able to avoid it. And eventually I moved back to Chicago. I had been in LA and was working for a startup website. And I had two similarly sort of defeating instances. One was in the Blackhawks locker room where one of my mentors in the industry, a longtime radio guy, was kind of doing some digging for me about why I had been kind of told to not be working in the clubhouse anymore in the locker room. They had said, oh, well, we're kind of doing the same thing as your website. You guys were being led in as a favor anyway, so we don't really need your coverage anymore. And I didn't know what to tell my bosses, and I didn't know what happened. And my radio friend did some digging and found that a older gentleman who'd been on the beat for a long time told the PR staff that I must be sleeping with the players because I was getting better stories than him. Meanwhile, I was a 27-year-old who connected with the players and asked them questions in a way that was fun and different. And the website I was working for was meant to be fun and voice of the player, very personality driven, not the same questions about whether their hamstring was going to be all right for their game on Tuesday. So I just approached it differently. I don't even know that any of the players knew my name, not to mention was I physically with any of them. So it was just the lashing out of an older guy watching a woman come into his space. And that was really, really hard. I thought, how am I supposed to do my job if I don't have access? I had to start driving 2 hours to go to this store where some of the players would do signings and asking if they'd be willing to do a quick interview with me while I was there. There was even later in the season at one point where two of the players said I could come to their house to interview them because they knew that I was being blackballed for absolutely no reason. And they had always gotten along with me and thought that I was fun and doing good things for them. One player's family even came into town and gave me this big hug. Oh my gosh, you're capturing his personality so well and helping the fans get to know why we love him so much. He's such a great kid. And I was really giving the fans all these great views of these players in ways they hadn't seen them before. And because that was different, this writer, this older guy, had decided that there must be something salacious going on. And so that radio mentor that I had, really, I was really upset. And he said, all you can do is put your head down and work as hard as you can and be as good as you can until you're so good that they can't say no, that they won't keep you out of the locker room, that they won't say no to you for assignments. And I went on to work in the Cubs, and something similar happened. One of the women that I worked with was in a meeting, and one of the PR people said, well, you know, I just really think her breasts are distracting in the locker room. And she said, well, what's she supposed to do with them? Can't hang them up outside and pick them up on her way out. Like, there's no hook for them that she can. And I had been so aware of how I carried myself and what I wore and everything else there because I had had issues in the previous locker room. And I was trying my best to be a fly on the wall. And I said, is this just what it's like if you're a woman, especially a 6 foot tall, curvy woman who is going to stand out whether or not I was trying my best to not? And so it was really disheartening. And I went back to that same mentor. I said, what can I do if I want to work in the city and cover these teams? I'm not doing anything wrong, and I'm still getting this reaction, this treatment. Same advice, like, you just have to keep finding ways around it. And eventually, when I got the gig with ESPN, that was the magic four letters. They can't say no. You're too good. They can't say no. And some of the same people who treated me so poorly, oh, I saw you on Oberman. Such a smart content, you know, so smart what you had to say. Great piece. And I realized that it was this sort of unfair trial by fire of, we're going to assume that you're one way and that you aren't smart and capable and here for the right reasons and doing your job. But once you do prove that, then everything's okay. And unfortunately for women, a lot of times you have to do that. And it's an unfair double standard that men in the industry don't have to face. And it probably weeds out a lot of women who don't think it's fair and who don't want to have to deal with that. And that stinks. It stinks that women might be scared away from the industry because of that.
On a positive note, Sarah turns this double standard negative into a positive. And she took matters into her own hands. Sarah had a hashtag More Than Mean PSA campaign around men reading vile tweets to female sports writers. You'll get the gist.
All right, you ready to do some mean tweets?
I'm ready.
Sarah Spain sounds like a nagging wife on TV today.
Not even married yet.
Julie DeCaro is a run-of-the-mill, mediocre beat writer.
Not atrocious, not good.
Just sort of there.
I'm actually not a beat writer at all, but okay.
Sarah Spain is just a scrub muffin.
I don't even know what a scrub muffin is.
I don't either.
I love muffins.
One of the players should beat you to death with their hockey stick.
Like the whore you are.
I'm just reading this.
Okay.
I mean, okay, this is why we don't hire any females unless we need our sucked or our food cooked.
Sarah Spain is a self-important know-it-all. Okay.
Just read the tweets, man. There's some mean tweets.
F this dumb.
There's a lot of C word.
There's a lot of C words. In
yeah. Here. Yeah. I hope your dog gets hit by a car, you.
And keeping the most people happy is to just be the girl who everyone wants to grab a beer and watch sports with. But that doesn't feel right to me. It feels like when I've achieved a certain amount of success and agency, I want to pay it forward by helping the people coming next, by making the industry better, by being open and vocal about the issues that we still have and the things that women still face, so that when women are coming up, they don't feel alone, so that they feel like other successful women have gone through this before, have made it through, and have found their way on the other end. And so this guy, Brad Burke, approached me about doing this PSA that just sort of illustrated in a different way from another article the harassment that female sports reporters face online just for doing their jobs, just for being in a male-dominated space that too many men think doesn't allow for women. And so Julie DeCaro, who's another sports reporter in Chicago, and I were the only ones that said yes. He asked maybe 6 or 7 women reporters. And they had guys that we didn't know and that didn't know what they were coming to do. They just said they were going to read mean tweets, read actual social media comments from some of our worst trolls to our face. And they wanted to show that it's much more difficult for both sides when you're saying these words to somebody's face instead of using the anonymity of the internet. And there are so many studies about how physiologically our body reacts to the social cues of others, whether that's the look in their eyes or the movement of their mouth or the way they carry their body. And it really physically taps into our empathy when we are making someone feel bad. And of course, you can still do that if you want. You can still face-to-face be an awful person to somebody, but you then have to absorb the cues that they're giving you back about how you're making them feel and what it really means to say these things. When you're online, you don't have that. You don't see the person that you're talking to and how they're reacting and whether you might be hurting them. You don't know anything about them or what's going on in their life when you do this. And so this video of us taking on these comments from somebody 4 feet away, and the reactions of the men versus our reactions. Julie and I have been going through it for so many years that we weren't surprised, but these men were really surprised to hear comments like, I hope you get raped again. I hope you're Bill Cosby's next victim. I hope your boyfriend beats you. I'd like to hate F you. The worst of the worst. And I as much as it's disappointing in some ways that seeing men be vulnerable and react to this was the power of this video, that is the case. We hear enough women talking about how bad we have it, and sometimes we get so accustomed to just saying, oh, we get it, and not wanting to listen to women when they tell their experiences. But there's a very visceral reaction to seeing men be so vulnerable, to seeing men be so traumatized. And I think that was the difference in the video. And it ended up winning a Peabody Award and a Sports Clio and shortlisted for Cannes. It got so much publicity. It went viral, millions and millions of views. And it really felt like a powerful moment. It hasn't fixed things, but it really, I think, shined a light for people who didn't quite understand the vitriol coming our way merely for wanting to do the job, right? It's not about, I don't like your opinion on this team or this quarterback. It's, you don't belong here. And I think for me, it's important to keep shining a light on those things, to do podcasts about women in the industry who face sexual harassment, to do podcasts about the difficulty of what to wear on screen because you know the comments and the sexualization is coming, even if you do your best to have it be about the work and not about your body. It is getting so much better, so, so much better, but it's not fixed. And so I think it's important for me to keep finding ways to make things better for women coming up.
And we thank you. Because you've definitely been thrown to the wolves. You're leading the pack by now, which is so good to see that you hung in there and you were able to see yourself through those ugly, inappropriate moments enough to send a message or share a message, spin it in a positive light to say, hey, you can't continue to do this. You don't control me. You can't bully me.
Well, the advice that I love to give, and I think it applies to any job, but specifically to my industry too, is to really figure out what makes you special, because it's such a crowded industry. And when I was coming up, I read this book and I would never be able to tell you the author or the title or anything. It was sort of just a throwaway paperback that was supposed to give you all the tips you needed when you moved to LA about how to become an actress. And here's the agencies you're supposed to look at. And here's the Samuel French bookstore where you can find your sides for monologues and everything else. But there was a section about figuring out who you were and what you brought. And there's this guy, Bobcat Goldthwait, who was the star way back when. And he kind of, for those who are younger, is maybe a little bit Pee Wee Herman-esque in terms of just being a little quirky, not the norm. And the book sort of said, there was no one in Hollywood that said, we need a guy like this. It was instead that he showed up and created a space for himself. And so rather than approaching your career by saying, I want to be the next fill in the blank, Erin Andrews or Stuart Scott or Sage Steele or Jemele Hill or whatever, you can look up to them. You can admire the things they do. You can learn from them, but be yourself and figure out what makes you special. And I think for me, that really allowed me to say, I'm going to take all of my Second City comedy, my own background in sports, my sports fandom, I'm going to put it all together and I'm going to try to create a space for myself in the industry that at the time I didn't see. There are now lots of funny women. Michelle Beadle and Katie Nolan are two of my favorites, but at the time there really weren't. There wasn't a space for women to be funny in sports. And I think just reading that and kind of taking in that note was super important for me to get, what do I bring that's different? How am I unique? And instead of trying to be what everybody thinks is this very reportery voice or articulating your words like this when you do your stories. I don't talk like that, and that's okay. And show up and be myself and own it and see if I can be embraced for that. And the further I've gotten and the more I realize that my gut instincts and who I am and what I think is good content and what I think are good ideas is right and validated by my bosses and my fans and everything else, the more I'm sort of pushed along by that belief of bringing my own self and creating a space for it. So I think you will discover the many ways in which you have to conform or understand a business in order to succeed in it, but never forget that there's that through line of whatever makes you very special and unique. And that's a lot harder to accept when you're just coming up. You have to fake it till you make it. You're not gonna have a bunch of fans and colleagues and bosses respecting you and telling you how great you are. You have to believe it. And even if you don't, you have to fake it and believe it and pretend you believe it until you get that validation. And it can be harder when you're young, but as you get older, you realize all those unique things about you are the gold. That's the great stuff. That's what allows you to come and teach other people how to get through bad situations, or that where you came from was okay because it's different and unique, or that what you believe on this or that, or what skills you have are special. And then you get there and you realize that that's all the good stuff.
And then lastly, we're going to keep it 100 here. We celebrate embarrassment. So in your 37 years on this earth, I want you to name three embarrassing moments that you're willing to share and celebrate, because either you've learned from it, you're over it, it might have like made you, just beat red, but overall, whether it's dating, it's a relationship, whether it's a girlfriendship, whether it's something work-related, just something where you're keeping it 100 with everybody about this is the reality of being a woman. Maybe it's something womanhood-related. If you want to share 1 to 3 embarrassing moments.
Okay, I'm going to go with things that popped into my head because that seems to be the way to go. We'll start way back. I was in my high school talent show and I sang Donna Summer's Last Dance in a sequin dress and high heels. And I brushed my hair out super frizzy and I had backup dancers, all my friends. We went downtown and got awesome like 70s clothes and we were performing. And so there was a full packed rehearsal because people who weren't able to make one of the Friday or Saturday shows came to the Thursday night dress rehearsal. And I was wearing these giant heels, walking down a thing of steps that were built by the class, you know, the people in the studio behind the scenes. And I fell down the stairs while singing. And that wasn't cool. But I laughed it off and I kept performing and it was terribly embarrassing, but the show must go on. The show must go on. I don't think I actually flashed anyone. I think it was more just down the stairs in my sequins with the mic in my hand. And my friends had not come out to dance yet. Cause you know, the beginning of the song is very like, ooh, you know, all that. And then it's like Last Dance. So they hadn't come out yet. And they just hear this. And they're like, oh no, what happened? But I made it. It was fine. I didn't fall Friday or Saturday. Probably made me a little more careful on the stairs for the real shows. So I guess that's what I learned. The show must go on and tread carefully in heels, which I still have to, cause I don't wear them very often. Moving on, I remember I got my very first and only sidelines reporting gig. And I don't really love sidelines reporting. It's a whole lot of work. There's not a lot of personality in it. You come in for your little 2 minutes, you give your report, you throw back up, you come back for an injury, you throw back up. And there isn't a lot of room for personality. But I had gotten this anecdote about this statue right outside where the University of Illinois guys come out of the tunnel for football. And they all, you know, they touch it or whatever on their way out for luck. And I've never been good with numbers. And I should have just not included how much the statue weighed. No one needed to know what the statue weighed. It was not important. But I decided in my report, as I'm talking about this statue and what it means and everything else, I'm going to say how much it weighed. And I got the number completely wrong. It was like, instead of 1 ton, I said 100 tons or 1,000 tons or whatever. And I got corrected on social media by multiple people. And I was mortified that I had made a mistake. And now I've made a million mistakes. And I'm like, who cares? But right. At the time, I had just gotten started and it was my first time. And I felt so much pressure to get it right that I couldn't believe that I had made this mistake. And it wasn't important. It didn't matter. Most people probably didn't even notice. They don't care how much it weighs and they don't know how much it weighs. But I really internalized that error. And one thing that I've realized as I've gotten older is it shows way more confidence and certainty with yourself to own those errors instead of trying to cover them up or try to defend them. Just, oh, well, I messed that up, whatever. Because I have great mentors in this industry and guys that I really respect who know so much and they'll still be like, actually, I don't know who the coach of the Nets is. Does anyone know who the coach of the Nets is? And it's something that you would think they would need to know, but we can't know everything. And as soon as you accept that you can't know everything and as soon as you accept that you are good enough and smart enough and you have all the abilities to be in there, it's much easier to accept when you make a mistake. And everybody around you lets it just you know, wash right away if you act like it's not that big of a deal. If you freak out about your own mistakes, everybody else is going to assume that there's reason for you to be so insecure. So that was horribly embarrassing at the time, but now I look back and it's just not the end of the world. I'm sure I have a million dating. What was embarrassing? I mean, almost everything about my dating life is embarrassing.
Did you ever date a short guy?
I did. I dated a couple short guys. One was a hockey player who ended up playing a little in the NHL. So he didn't seem as short because he was just like, he had crazy confidence and he was this great athlete. But I also dated a short guy who was like kind of a pale Irish guy, but he would learn all the songs that I love and play them for me on the guitar and sing. And that's like my sweet spot. So he got away with being short because he was a musician, which is a total, you know, the musician card is a tough one to beat. Man, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I think the thing that I just learned most from any of my embarrassing moments with guys is something that my girlfriend taught me that was really key. She's just this beautiful blonde. And I remember the first year that I had met her, the first Valentine's Day, she had three sets of flowers that showed up at her door and two separate dinner dates that she went on. And I was like, what is this girl's secret? I'm at home alone with my friend watching The Notebook and eating Chinese food. Like, how does she have all these dates? And one of the things she taught me was you have to demand that they treat you the way that you want to. If you don't show up if they text you at 11:30 and want you to come over and they've never taken you on a date. If you want to be treated the way that you want to be treated, you have to demand it and you have to act like you're deserving of it because they're only going to treat you as well as you treat yourself. And I really didn't have the confidence in myself to ask for that. I really let a lot of guys treat me poorly, not anything, abusive physically or mentally or anything like that. But I just didn't demand the respect that I was owed, especially in my early 20s, to be wooed and be taken out on dates and to be treated like someone who is deserving of real affection and be your girlfriend and not just someone they hang out with. And as soon as I kind of learned that from her, it really changed everything for me. And that's kind of like the confidence you need for your job. It's hard to do when you're younger. So you got to fake it till you make it. If you don't feel it, you got to pretend like you do, because that's going to have others around you treating you the way you deserve.
And that wraps up another episode of the Keep It 100 Girl Show. Your go-to girlfriend is here to empower you every week, ladies. We celebrate embarrassment, self-love, and those life lessons that make you go, sheesh. Life is too short. Don't worry about stupid people and stupid things. Have fun, regret nothing, and don't let people and the worst of people bring you down. The fact that you all are open, vulnerable, and honest with me is a true testament of what Keep It 100 really means. But wait a minute, before you go, I want you to do two things. If you like this episode or any other ones, kindly leave me a rating and 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. I rely on it a lot because it helps me stand out from the crowd and helps women, and even you men, understand us better. Don't forget, tune in on Friday for my Keep It 100 moment. If you like my style and my episodes, spread the good word using the handle @NinaBabel. Share my podcast on social, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and my Facebook Keep It 100 Girl page. If you want to share your story, drop me a line, question, story request, or pitch your own, then use my direct email address, ask@NinaBabel.com. Smooches!